This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 92-year-old Joe Hardin of Hillmar, California. As a first scout serving on the Philippine islands of Leyte and Mindanao with the 24th Infantry Division in World War II, I'm sure you're not going to be surprised to hear that he experienced some close calls.
We were advancing with tanks at one time, and there was a bar ditch coming into the side. They stopped the tanks. Well, when you advance with tanks, let me tell you, you have to go up a road with tanks over there because, you know, the jungle is soft, the tank will bog down. So you go up a road. Well, when you advance with tanks, your two scouts are out ahead of the tank. Sound funny? You have two infantrymen on each side of the tank, the rest of the squad's in back. Your squad leader is talking to the guys in the tank. They have a phone on the back. But that's the way you advance with tanks. We stopped with the tank at one time, and there was a bar ditch, and I stepped up in the bar ditch, leaning against the side, and a bullet ricocheted off the road. And I didn't know where somebody was that was shooting at me, but I figured they were shooting someplace in my direction. And another shot hit the road. I was leaning close to the bank, and I heard the noise on the when he jacked another shell into the chamber. That soldier was in the same trench I was in. It was a drainage trench, you know, coming down. But he had two shots at me, and he never hit me either time. And their rifle was a bolt action, and they had a mud guard, and that mud guard was made out of a heavy sheet tin, and it made a clank, clank noise when they jacked another shell in. And that's the way I heard him, because I didn't know where the bullet came from.
So are you insinuating that then once you knew where he was, you were able to neutralize that threat?
Well, I jumped up, fired back at him, and got the heck out of there. I didn't know if I got him or not. I never went up there to find out. But I got down onto the road, and I couldn't see up that trench line because of the rise off the road.
How far away do you think he was?
75, 80 yards. He wasn't a very good shot.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because the first thing I noticed when I walked into your home here in Hillmar was a beautiful buck on the wall. I didn't count the points.
Three-pointer. But that deer was in Vell early in the season.
Well, I know that's not the only deer that you've caught. There's a lamp behind you that's made out of antlers, and I know you lived in Alaska for a while where you could practically live on the deer. So my point is, if you were sizing up a deer from 75 or 80 yards, what would be the likelihood that that deer would be dropped?
When I hunted in Alaska, the first deer I shot in Alaska, I shot running, and I hit him through the shoulders. I knew right then that going through the shoulders, you ruin meat. All the time I was in Alaska, which was about 4 years, I never shot another deer through the shoulders. I shot every deer through the head. Because up there, we'd sit, watch, and when a deer come out, he had to be on the high side of the road. If he's on the low side of the road, we'd never shoot him. If he's on the high side of the road, you wait till he got down fairly close. Take your time. I still have that rifle.
Well, and so what you're telling us is that you're a pretty good shot, and if you were standing 75 or 80 yards away, you probably wouldn't have missed. So how fortunate were you that that enemy soldier didn't hit you in that scenario?
I often wonder. Either he was scared or I don't know how he acted in when you see an enemy. I know how I acted, but when I was advancing, I carried a Thompson submachine gun. And I had two clips, 20 rounds apiece, taped together so I could fire 20 rounds, turn the clip over, shove it in, fire 20 more rounds. But altogether, I carried 19 clips, 20 rounds apiece. I carried a little ammunition, but I never wanted to run out.
Well, understandably so. And I'm sure that's not the only close call that you experienced over that. That's one that you shared about. Are there some other instances that you look back on, you say, boy, how did I get out of that?
Well, I wrote a little poem about one day as a scout. I fired at the side of a building as I seen the muzzle of a rifle around the corner, just the muzzle of the rifle sticking up. And I knew somebody was there. The first few rounds with the Thompson submachine gun wouldn't make it through corrugated iron, you know, the corrugation like they put on the sides of buildings or the roofs. But after one clip, well, I punched some holes in it. Then when I moved ahead, I went ahead about 45, 50 feet, and I needed a drink of water. So I sat down, and I was in kunai grass, which was about 3 foot tall. And across the kunai grass, not 50 feet, was the edge of the abaca. And one of the enemy stepped out of the abaca and was standing there looking around. I fired at him, got my drink, put my canteen back, got ready to move, looked up, and there was another one standing there looking down at the one that I'd shot at before. I fired at him, and they sent the guy that was second scout up to me because the squad leader, the company commander, asked what the hell was happening up there because they couldn't see where I was at. The squad leader told him he didn't know it was his scout that was out there. And about that time, they opened up on the center of our column with a 50 caliber, their 50 caliber type machine gun, and we had to withdraw. What we run into was there were too many of them for just our group, so we pulled back.
What does that feel like in those moments? How much adrenaline starts pumping through you when you're taking a break for a sip of water and you look up and see a guy who could kill you if you're not fast enough?
Well, I couldn't walk. I was so tight, you know, my muscles were so tight. I could make some quick steps, jump, and run, but walking slow was awful hard. Fear is, you can't really explain it until you're under that yourself. But for me, my muscles just tightened up. To walk was just, I could jump and run, but I couldn't walk.
Well, and did that ever change? Is it something you ever got used to, or was it like that the whole time you were over there in combat?
No, I was just scouting, I could, you know, move along slow. But once that you knew there was somebody there, then the fear builds up in you so much that it just your muscles are tight. With me, anyway, I know some of the guys that were with me, they could fire an M1 pretty well. Now, I never had to worry about, you know, really taking a bead on somebody, because with a Thompson submachine gun, you don't really use the sights. You point and fire.
Well, and you just described for us a couple instances where you came really close to being wounded or killed in action. I'm just imagining that for the amount of time you spent over there and the situations you found yourself in, you did have to deal with guys around you getting hit. How hard was that to see a guy that you've trained with, served with, fought with, be killed or wounded in action?
Well, it was pretty hard. We had one group, was a double squad. A guy, his first name was Richard, the squad leader on that other squad. We called him Big Dick. He's a big, tall kid. And they got into it bad, and him and two other guys, I can't think of one of them's name. I know one of them was Billy Ireland. He was from Mill Valley. One of the fellows in his squad was his next-door neighbor, and they were buddies in Mill Valley. His buddy got hit. He was trying to help him, but the kid was bleeding to death. Klassen was his name, and he was crying for his mother, which most men do if they're wounded and they feel they're going to go. And then Billy Ireland we got them out of there, but then Billy Ireland was never the same after that. His buddy, he wasn't in my squad. He was in his second squad. It's hard. We had one medic. His last name was Ratto. He was wounded. He was still running on his ankle, helping the wounded guys. And you can't imagine the fear. You're scared. I don't know what really being brave is, because I was scared all the time.
Did you ever find anything that helped with that? If you see these guys get hit one day and you know you're going right back into the same thing tomorrow, how do you keep believing that that's not going to happen to you?
You're just hoping and praying it doesn't. Although there was some fellas in my outfit that had been in there a long time, and they grew callous and they wanted to get wounded, not killed, but they would have liked to got wounded so they could get out.
That's how horrible it was to be living that reality day after day.
Yeah, it's not fun. Not fun at all.
Did you have any sense of what you guys were accomplishing while you were there?
Well, it's we know we were winning because we were pushing them and pushing them. On Mindanao, we pushed them clean up into an area where there were some primitive people that lived in that area, and they didn't really want us to go in there. They were afraid we'd pass some simple disease on them that would kill them. But we just went and pushed and pushed. And of course, a lot of the Japanese lived after the war, hidden out on those islands, and didn't even know the war was over.
Well, how did you know the war was over? What do you remember about that?
We had pulled back. We were down near the road, supposedly their highway, that run along the coast. And they sent six of us out on a bridge guard on this road. We had pulled back down from combat. We drove them up there so far. There were six of us on this bridge guard, and we knew the direction where our company battalion was at. And in the middle of the night, we seen tracers flying up, and we thought the company got hit. The next thing we knew, this Jeep was coming down the road with the lights on, and we thought it was guys trying to escape. And they came up, stopped, and told us the war was over. But we stayed there. We had to stay there on that bridge anyway, because we didn't know if the Japanese realized it was over, and they didn't. But we pulled back and went back onto the beach, reassembled, and the Filipino guerrillas went in and tried to get the Japanese to come back out.
After being in harm's way so much for so long, was it a relief to hear that Japan has surrendered and this war's over?
Oh, yeah. It was a real relief, yeah. But, you know, combat, it's hard to explain, because with me, I was always scared. You know, when we were in combat, I was always scared. So consequently, when it was over, I was relieved, but we knew it was over. But the Japanese on that island, most of them didn't know. They were back. We've driven them back into the jungles in the wild country. So when we pulled back, we left that to the Filipinos.
Well, what you're saying is that could have been a dangerous job, because they don't know or believe that it's over. So what's to stop them from taking a shot at you?
Oh, yeah. Because a lot of the Japanese, it was months and months they had to get them off some of those islands, because they didn't know it was over on Mindanao. That's a big island. And then back in the center part of that island, they got some wild people.
But you had another landing to make. The war's over. Japan surrendered. But they sent you guys where?
We landed Shikoku Matsuyama. We made a combat landing there. But when we landed, S1 sent a jeep in, because we knew where we had to go, or they knew where we had to go, and they sent an S1 jeep ahead of us. They were reconnaissance, and I was in the second jeep, and I had one fellow with me on a machine gun mounted with a windshield down. We got kind of off the track, but we found our way back, and we went up to where the company was going to move in the morning. It was an airfield when we were going to bivouac there. We found the other jeep. We had sleeping bags, and we went in and found the barracks, but we laid down in the barracks. In about 15 minutes, we got back up and got out of there and slept in the jeep. The barracks were full of fleas. We couldn't even use our sleeping bags. We didn't know what was biting us, but something was biting us. But the next day, the company moved in, and we set up squad tents on the airfield. It was a training airfield for the Japanese army. But the people were gone. And when the women did come out of the hills, they were wearing, I think they called them booties, but they were like long knickers down to their ankles. They didn't wear kimonos and obis. They wore those because they could run. They were scared of what the American soldiers were going to do to them. But we didn't.
Well, what did you guys do, and how long were you over there?
I don't remember how long I was in Japan. I guess about 18 months, something like that, before I got out of there. I had transferred into the motor pool. I ended up as a T4, which is a sergeant. I was a sergeant over the motor pool. Had a good job. We had that Japanese guy you saw the picture of. They sent him to us so he could help us. When we were working on jeeps and everything, we'd take them apart. We had these Japanese guys would clean up the parts, and we'd inspect them and put things back together new, you know, or repair, because we had to bring all our vehicles up to, you know, they were in good shape, because we chased all over Japan when we first got there. We'd take jeeps and convoy and go out, and we spiked their coastal guns. You know what that means? We take a thermite grenade and shove it down the barrel, throw it down the barrel of their coastal guns, and it gets so hot it melts the mechanism on the inside, and you can't open the breech to put a shell in it. It just melts the steel. It bonds together. We had to do that, and then we go around and take inventory of warehouses. They'd come and collect all their arms. They loaded their rifles and everything. They had stacks of rifles, just big piles of rifles. Some of them as big as a house, and they'd just take them down to the beach, load them on landing craft, take them out to the Japanese trench. That's deep water out there. I guess it's 3 or 4 miles, maybe it's deep, and dump all that stuff in the ocean.
There was something else he saw in Japan that very few people saw the way he did, and we'll hear about that when we come back. Imagine a 19-year-old driving into the blast zone at Hiroshima. He'll tell us what it was like when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.